You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile. And the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time. There's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. With all the stresses of life, it can be easy to lose perspective on what really matters. But Heineken believes that life is about being with friends and opening yourself to new experiences. Because when you live spontaneously and embrace the unexpected, it's a chance to create new stories and connections. You just have to open it. So enjoy a refreshingly cold, full-bodied Heineken Lager today. With its deep golden color, light fruity aroma, mild bitter taste, and a crisp, clean finish. Cheers. And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. If you've ever been browsing Facebook and curiously clicked on an article with a headline like Nikki Haley resigns to accept consulting role with Afghan warlord, or Augusta National honors Tiger Woods with own drinking fountain, then you've probably been duped by The Onion, a humor website disguised as a serious news outlet that publishes razor-sharp satire lampooning politics, entertainment, and everything in between. Now in its 30th year, The Onion is the original inventor of fake news, developing a loyal following and infiltrating the culture, even to the point that whenever Americans see a news piece that sounds too absurd to be true, they say it must be from The Onion. Stranger yet, any number of major media outlets over the years have mistakenly reported The Onion's parody articles as real news. My guest today says it's all in good fun. He's Scott Dickers, the founder of The Onion and its longest-serving editor-in-chief. Today, Scott discusses how The Onion got its start on college campuses, how he drew inspiration from National Lampoon and Spy Magazine and eventually outlasted them both, and how they did such a good job that they couldn't find advertisers for fear that readers wouldn't take their products seriously. He recalls the article about Bill Clinton and the war in Bosnia that prompted The Onion to finally go online, and how years before The Daily Show, he and a young Stephen Colbert parodied cable news on the short-lived Dana Carvey Show. Then Scott shares why he's turning his sharp wit on billionaire Elon Musk in a new book called Welcome to the Future, in parentheses, which is mine. We talk about Musk's latest troubles with the SEC and his own board of directors, ponder whether Elon Musk might be a Bond villain, and speculate on what he might invent next and what it's like to work for a mad genius. Plus, how The Onion fooled Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and the article that led Donald Trump to threaten to sue. Coming up with Scott Dickers in just a moment. Scott Dickers is the founder of the satirical website The Onion and is the publication's long-serving editor-in-chief. He currently heads the Writing with The Onion program in partnership with The Onion and The Second City in Chicago. He's also authored a number of bestsellers, including Our Dumb Century, which hit number one on the New York Times bestseller list and earned him a Thurber Prize for humor writing. Now Scott Dickers lampoons Elon Musk in his new book, Welcome to the Future, Which is Mine, by Not Elon Musk and Scott Dickers. Scott, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Ben. You sum up my life pretty good. Make me sound pretty accomplished there.
Well, and I did leave out one thing. Apparently, it says here that you won a Peabody Award. Is that right?
Yeah. The Peabody is not awarded to people. It's awarded to work. So the online videos that we did that I was the executive producer of and was very heavily involved in won. So, yeah, what the heck? I won the Peabody. We'll just go with that.
Did you ever think there was a Peabody Award in your future?
I really did not. We used to joke about winning a Pulitzer, and we found out, I guess, a few years after that we were a finalist for the Pulitzer after our 9/11 issue. But all these sorts of, like, you know, legitimate news accolades is crazy. But that's where we live in the upside down, so it's all good.
And I mentioned that The Onion is a satirical website. Just in case a few of the people listening don't know what I'm talking about, here are a couple of the sample headlines from The Onion today. Lindsey Graham dining alone at Applebee's kind of wishes protesters would come heckle him. And here's another one. Kavanaugh impressed by hazing rituals before they let you join the Supreme Court.
And I should specify, like, there's a lot of fake news out there, like satire that comes in news parody format. They're all copying The Onion because we came first. And so I'll take full credit for all these problems that we're having in the world today.
The Onion practically invented fake news in the sense that it was literally making up news. Do you get annoyed when that term gets applied not to deliberate satire like The Onion, but to legitimate news sources like The New York Times or CNN?
Yeah. No, I get annoyed by that. And I get annoyed by – and not to say that those news organizations don't have their bias. That's part of what The Onion is lampooning, is how we're all humans and we all have a bias, and you have to know that going in. But it really bothers me when people put out propaganda as news, like they did during the 2016 election, like Russians or who knows what else, and then they put the word satire on it, because they're just conflating satire and fake news, which is in their case just pure propaganda that's trying to fool people on purpose, which The Onion never tried to do. We just tried to entertain. And then if people were fooled by it, well, that was just funny and they were punked, and they would they'd get a good laugh once they realized that they'd been punked and nobody gets hurt.
And how did The Onion get started? It was a college paper, right?
Yeah, it was just a college newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. Circulation about 15,000. And it started in 1988. With no money of any kind, and it didn't make a lot of money for the first few years. And we just tried to put together – I became owner-editor as of about year two. I had been involved since the beginning. And we just tried to collect a bunch of funny people around town, and there were surprisingly a lot of them, and formed this really close-knit group of, you know, just kind of misfits and people who didn't really belong anywhere else, who – loved comedy and loved making each other laugh. And we tried to put out the funniest thing we could. We'd put out an issue every week during the school year. And we did this for many years and then started to make a little money at it, started to become kind of a going concern. People started to see it and appreciate it outside of Madison, Wisconsin. And we were, you know, doing pretty well when the internet came around in 1995 and we went online. And suddenly our readership increased by a factor of like a billion, which was really good for us. Yeah. And so – but the slow growth of The Onion continued. We had a lot of exposure, but we still, you know, weren't making the big bucks. But then we – a few years after that, we put out our first book, which was a bestseller. And, you know, over the years, you do a few other things that sort of put The Onion on the map. And I remember in the early years, it was – very often that people hadn't heard of it, didn't know what it was, got very confused even when they saw it, because it was kind of a new thing. Humor came in the form of magazines typically, like the National Lampoon or Mad or whatever.
Right. And Spy Magazine was still around back then, right?
They were in their heyday.
But you were kind of at the tail end of those, Lampoon and Spy Magazine. They kind of wound down around, what, the mid or early 90s?
Yeah, the National Lampoon has had a slow, painful death, but Spy kind of went away suddenly in the early 90s. And it was, you know, a great satirical magazine, some of the best writing in American humor, I think, in all of American history. And every week The Onion would come out with a new issue, and I would compare it to the latest issue of Spy, and I would just get depressed because I knew The Onion was never going to be as good or as big as Spy Magazine.
Yeah, and I wonder, when you started out, did you have a hard time finding advertisers for The Onion? I mean, did they worry that readers might think that their product was a joke?
Yeah, in fact, that was a problem that we had. People, readers, thought that everything in The Onion was fake. So even the advertising. So we'd go to a local pizza place and they'd run coupons in The Onion as a test to see if people came in and used the coupons. Then they would know that The Onion was a legitimate advertising vehicle and they were actually reaching people. But since readers thought they were fake, they wouldn't use them. And this was so frustrating to us. Like, we couldn't get through people's heads. Like, why would – we're already working so hard producing all the content. Why would we also make fake ads that are just yeah. for our own health? Like, it didn't make any sense. But that's what people thought. And so we created – the AV Club, which was the back half of the newspaper, which had actual movie showtimes and movie reviews and record reviews, which kind of legitimized the publication, made it seem like more of a real newspaper. And this helped because then people saw it more as a legitimate publication and started believing the ads. But it was funny because early on, even though we were printing like movie showtimes, sometimes we'd get them wrong. And so I remember getting a call once. A guy went to the movie at the wrong time because he saw it in The Onion, and he was laughing on the phone saying, oh, you got me, The Onion. Great prank. And I was telling him, no, that was just a mistake. We're trying to give you good information here.
And how long did it take before you realized that you were onto something with The Onion?
I mean, I thought we were onto something by the early 90s, so you know, maybe 4 or 5 years into it. But even before that, it was always fun and it was a total labor of love, even though there was really no money to be made. It seemed like it could make money because people liked it and it had a business model, you know, we sold advertising, and that wasn't my department. My department was coming up with the jokes. But yeah, when it started to make a little bit more and, you know, we started to pay people a little more, and even though some people, like, you know, the in-laws, for example, are confused by it and like, what are you doing for a living? it did start to become a thing that even though we were carving out this new type of humor publication, it was making money and it was getting noticed. And, you know, there's no predicting how that's all going to go, but you just keep doing your best and keep plugging away and putting out issues that you think are good. And yeah, it worked out.
And The Onion really took off with the advent of the internet. What was the thing that finally got The Onion online?
Well, my business partner and I argued about it because he didn't want to spend the $400 that was necessary to get an internet service provider, because in those days that was like a big deal. And none of us understood what any of this meant or what it was. There were a couple of guys on the tech side of the company who were like, yeah, we should probably put all this content that we're writing on a website. And we were thinking, well, what's a website? And so we convinced him to put up the money and we started putting The Onion online. And we didn't do anything else but just put what we were writing in the newspaper on the internet. And people noticed. We were the first humor website. And there weren't even a lot of newspapers online. So we got reviewed in The New Yorker like straight away, which was a really big deal to us. We got noticed by, you know, TV networks wanted to come and interview us. And it helped that we had been doing it for so many years prior to that, because at that point we were kind of getting good at it.
Wasn't the reason that you guys decided to start the website something like, I guess there was an article about Clinton and the war in Bosnia that got circulated all over the internet, but you guys weren't getting credit for it?
That was one of the things that was the impetus, yeah. So there was this article, Clinton deploys vowels to Bosnia. You know, to help make the city names more pronounceable. And it was during the Bosnian War. It was all chaos over there. So it was a really funny article written by Robert Siegel. And it was being circulated by email. People would just send it around with no attribution. And then the guys on Car Talk, the NPR show, read the whole story verbatim on their show and were just laughing and laughing and laughing. And it was one of these things where people thought, well, it's just one of these internet funny things that's going around. They don't think, well, somebody wrote it. I wonder who wrote it. But we contacted the Car Talk guys and they were very nice and they gave us credit on the next episode of their show. And we figured, yeah, part of being online would be, well, at least we'll have a record of putting these stories out there and people will know where they came from. Because we were always struggling to get noticed and grow and get known. And that was kind of a nightmare come true, that everybody was spreading our stuff and it was kind of going viral as much as stuff went viral before, you know, the modern internet. And we weren't getting any of the credit for it. It's pretty tragic.
Did your strategy change when you went online? Because I guess when you had it as a print publication, you know, anyone who looked at it was in on the joke already. Whereas once you were online, you had people who were circulating these articles to friends and families and using it to prank people.
Yeah, I think it made it easier to prank people once it was online. But the strategy didn't change. We made the newspaper look like a real newspaper because that's part of the parody. It's a lesson I learned from the National Lampoon. When you do parody, design it so it looks exactly like the thing you're parodying. It just makes it funnier. And online, we did the same thing. We made it look like a serious news website. And the responsibility comes back to the reader. You know, if you're not going to do your due diligence and check your sources, joke's on you. You know, if you're going to buy, if you're going to believe something.
Yeah.
And for everyone in the know, it's just a lot of fun.
Now, did you get more fun out of the cases where the reader was in on the joke, or was it more fun for you when you were able to put one over on them?
It is always an extra layer of joy when people, especially people who should know better, are taking onion stories seriously, like people in Congress or, you know, foreign governments. You know, the government of China has taken
really?
Our stories and believed them. The government of Iran, like Ahmadinejad, it was quoting a poll in The Onion that showed that he was more popular than Obama at one point. And he was very proud of that.
You're kidding.
So, yeah. No, it's true. And that is fun. It is super fun when that happens. Just adds another layer to the humor.
Who's the biggest person in Congress that you fooled?
I can't remember. You know, there's a website called Literally Unbelievable that catalogs all the times where The Onion was taken seriously by people. And I'm sure some of those incidences are there. And there's a subreddit, I think, Not The Onion, I think it's called.
Yeah.
That does the same thing. So people can look that up. It's really fun.
Yeah. Now, I think around the same time that you guys went on the internet, that was about the time that you did some spoof segments for the legendary but short-lived Dana Carvey show, working with Robert Smigel of SNL fame and a young Stephen
yes.
Colbert, who was the news reporter, right?
Yeah, yeah. Boy, that's awesome you remembered that. So, yeah, I was contacted by Robert Smigel because he loved The Onion. And I had actually tried to get a job on the Conan O'Brien show a couple years earlier by sending, you know, The Onion. So they all knew about The Onion. And I'm glad I didn't take the job, by the way. Not that it wouldn't have been pleasant, but I'm glad I stayed with The Onion longer. And they wanted to do an Onion news segment on the show. And so they bought a few Onion stories. And yes, a young Stephen Colbert was the guy who read those stories. And it was the first, you know, fake news that he read. And then what's so funny, it all comes around. When he worked at The Daily Show, the executive producer was Ben Carlin, who used to be the assistant editor of The Onion, who co-created the Colbert Show with him. So we're all kind of intertwined.
Small world. Did you see the documentary that they did on the Dana Carvey show?
Yeah, that was really fun. And there's a little clip of Stephen Colbert reading that Onion news on the doc.
As someone who was involved, I mean, the whole purpose of that documentary was trying to figure out how they could have so much talent on that show and yet it failed. Do you have any theories on that?
Yeah, it was just bad luck. They were put at the wrong time. They were in prime time on a network, on kind of a family network, and they did this skit that I thought was really funny where Bill Clinton had six breasts like a dog and he breastfed all these puppies and Dana Carvey was playing Bill Clinton. And I just thought it was delightful and funny. I remember watching it live. And then the next day, like the world reacted in horror and just thought it was way too over the top, offensive or whatever. And I just thought it was funny. You know,
yeah,
some of those
funny
guys like Louis C.K. and some of these other writers on staff knew what was funny. Like they were going for the jugular and they know that animals are funny because they're unpredictable and shock humor like that is funny. So, you know, good quality people. Steve Carell was on the show.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the material was great. But after that hit, they just never recovered.
Yeah.
That first hit. I think it was the first show. And I remember like we stopped talking to them after that first show because they were literally just dealing with the onslaught of trying to keep up and save their show from sponsors cutting out.
I assume that you must have had a lot of talent that's worked on The Onion over the years. Are there some writers who've gone on to big things?
Yeah, no, that's one of my biggest points of pride. So almost on every TV show, you know, there are Onion writers because so many people have worked for us in even a freelance capacity. But some of the ones that you might have heard of are, so Ben Carlin was the executive producer and showrunner of The Daily Show and The Colbert Show. Mm-hmm. Rich Dom was also at The Colbert Show, and he worked on The Middle, which is a network TV show. Ellie Kemper, who's the star of Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, she was a writer for us when we were doing web video. So was Chris Gethart, who has his own show. And Chris Kelly was one of our writers, and he went on to become the head writer of SNL.
Not bad. Not bad
and,
at all.
Yeah. Rob Siegel, who I mentioned, who wrote that Clinton deploys Vallis to Bosnia piece, he became a screenwriter and wrote a couple of excellent movies, one of which was nominated for an Oscar, The Wrestler with Mickey Rourke.
Now, I wonder about some of the close calls you guys have had over the years. Have you ever had an Orson Welles War of the Worlds moment when an article in The Onion caused some kind of mass panic?
I wish we had. Yeah, that would have been awesome. No. So we did have a front page once that had a giant, like 80-point type headline that simply said panic exclamation point. And but nobody panicked. Nobody cared. But no, so there have been a few, you know, instances where something in The Onion was believed on a really wide scale.
Mm-hmm. Like what?
Probably the biggest was The Onion story about this new abortion plex that was opening. It was like the Mall of America for abortions. And, you know, sometimes you write stories like that that inflame a certain very passionate political fringe.
Yeah.
And so they'll glom onto that and they'll say, see? You know, and that's part of why you do it, is to sort of goad them. But that one really took off because readers took the ball and ran with it, and they created a website for the abortion plex where you could go and leave reviews. You know, I was in and out in 2 minutes. Great abortion experience, you know.
Oh, really?
And it was just all created outside of us. You know, we just wrote the story, and it just took on a life of its own.
Interesting, like fan fiction.
Yes, yes.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Scott Dickers when we come back in just a minute. Life can be stressful, and sometimes we lose perspective on what really matters. As we rush to achieve all the things we want in life, it can be easy to forget to enjoy the smaller moments along the way. But life isn't about following a common path or having a set plan. It's about being with friends, celebrating with loved ones, and living in the moment. Heineken believes that you create the richest memories when you embrace the unexpected and open yourself to new experiences. That's why Heineken encourages everyone to live spontaneously. Because when you embrace the unexpected, things like exploring new parties, enjoying the summertime, watching exciting soccer matches, and celebrating the holidays with your family, all become chances to create new stories and connections. You just have to open it up. So enjoy a refreshingly cold, full-bodied Heineken Lager today. With its deep golden color, light fruity aroma, mild bitter taste, and a crisp, clean finish. Cheers. Folks, I'm so happy to have Bombas as a new sponsor of the podcast because I'm a huge sock guy. I know that sounds weird, but it's true. Everyone who's been on the show knows I always have some funky socks on my feet. Not funky as in smelly, but funky as in fun colors, whimsical, fashion forward, but also functional and comfortable. And as a sock connoisseur, let me say that nobody makes a better sock than Bombas. Thanks to 2 years of research and development and multiple improvements in design, performance, and comfort, Bombas are the most comfortable socks in the history of feet. With an arch support system that provides extra support where you need it most and a cushioned footbed that's reinforced for comfort without added bulkiness, Bombas feel like a hug around your foot. Not to mention, Bombas Stay Up technology ensures that your socks stay in place without leaving a mark. And the super soft cotton material makes you never want to take them off. So whether you're a runner, power walker, or power lounger, that's me, there's a pair of Bombas that'll add comfort to your life. As a matter of fact, I'm wearing a pair of purple Bombas Marl's calf-length socks even as we speak. They come in every color of the rainbow, and I ordered them all because they look great and they're easily the most comfortable socks I've ever owned. There's a good reason. These socks are scientifically engineered for comfort. Think about that. How much time do you spend trying to find a comfortable pair of shoes? Now ask yourself how much thought you've ever given to your socks. Socks go on your feet too, folks, and if you're suffering from tired feet, consider this. Maybe you've got the right shoes, but the wrong socks. You owe it to your feet to find out what a perfectly engineered sock feels like. Take it from me, they're a game changer. Go to bombas.com/kick and use the code KICK for 20% off your first order. That's Bombas, bombas.com/kick, code KICK, and you'll get 20% off your first order. And now, back to the podcast. Do you find that you have to tread a thin line between satire and either being offensive or being too cynical? Or do you think that, you know, if someone takes offense at something that's in the Onion, then they're probably not your audience anyway?
Yeah, I personally have never worried about that. I think most of the other writers at The Onion, there's a culture there where we don't care about your sensibilities. Like, we're going to say what we want to say, and if you don't like it, you can read something else. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the way it should work. Sometimes when something is going after the wrong target, it can be really offensive and just wrong-headed or whatever. But if you're writing good satire and your target is a worthy target, you know, you can say anything you want. And we're historically have all been very cynical people.
Yeah.
You know, that's – I think you kind of have to be to be a satirist. You go around thinking humans and life are just so stupid and there's so many ways in which it could be better and that's all you think about. And then once in a while you sneak a little bit of that satirical message into some comedy that you write and a lot of people relate. They may not think about it all the time like the sad sack satirist does, but it's fun to get a peek into that type of a brain once in a while, I think.
Now, were you there when the 9/11 issue came out?
No, I had just left. It was all
left because that's when they moved to New York, for a brief period.
Yeah, so they were all people that I had hired, and Robert, the editor, had been my right-hand man, and I was so proud of them. It was just such a great issue that they put together.
Yeah, and it was pretty brave because I remember in those days immediately following 9/11, comedians weren't just talking about whether they can talk about 9/11. People were asking, when is it going to be okay just to be funny?
Mm-hmm.
When is it going to be okay to laugh again?
Yeah, and I think we had a good experience producing our book just a few years before that, actually mm-hmm. 1 or 2 years before, Our Dumb Century, which was a look back at the history of the 20th century through fake front pages of The Onion. And so we had done all these comedy takes on these big tragic historic events like Pearl Harbor, the Titanic, the Hindenburg, you know, Kennedy assassination, etc. And so when 9/11 happened, that staff was really experienced at handling those kinds of things really well. Mm-hmm. And they knew the whole equation of comedy equals tragedy plus time. And we had played with that in our book. And it was so interesting when you make a joke about the Titanic, nobody cares because it's 100 years ago. But then you get up closer to the present. We're making jokes about the federal building explosion in Oklahoma City, which happened just a couple of years before that book came out. But when you put them all under the same cover, you kind of have to treat them the same. You can't treat one with kid gloves because it was more recent. And that's when we realized the real formula is comedy equals tragedy, period. Like if you want to add time or distance to that equation – maybe that'll make it more appropriate to some people or other. But we knew that by hitting the right target, you can do comedy at any time. So when 9/11 happened, everybody was thinking about 9/11. What else are you going to write about? But the stories weren't making fun of the victims. They weren't doing anything like that. Weren't making light of the tragedy. They were cathartic. And one of the articles was terrorists surprised to find themselves in hell. And the whole article was just this totally cathartic description of how these terrorists were being tortured in hell. And it was just really fun and delightful to read, you know?
Yeah. Now, The Onion's been sued a number of times, I think. At one point, didn't you get sued by Donald Trump even?
I need to correct you there. The Onion has never been sued. We've had threats of lawsuits a lot.
Okay.
Yeah. So Donald Trump did threaten to sue the Onion at one point. We made some joke about him having a small penis. It wasn't a particularly great joke or anything, but he did not like that. So we got a letter from Michael Cohen, and this is back in 2013, I want to say, saying that Donald Trump is an important businessman and he is not to be made fun of and you must take down this story immediately. It's a disgrace, et cetera. And we, like in any case like that, we ignore the letter and just keep doing what we're doing. But he doesn't give up. He writes back and then he starts calling. And he's calling our CEO, Steve Hanna at the time, and just bugging him about this issue and threatening to sue. And we know they don't have a leg to stand on because there's this thing called the First Amendment for now.
Yeah.
That we can print just about anything we want as long as you're making fun of a public figure and you're not defaming anyone. And this kept on going. And then when the presidential election started happening and we found out about the story where Trump was calling People magazine pretending to be his own publicist using a fake name, you know, John Barron or whatever, you know, plugging his nose and saying, Donald Trump, all the women want to have sex with Donald Trump.
Yeah, I remember.
It made me realize – it made me go back and look at that letter and realize, no, that wasn't Michael Cohen. That was Donald Trump. Because I was looking at the letter and it was like, those are his words, disgraceful. You know, you must apologize to Mr. Trump, the fourth grade sentence structure, et cetera. And it was probably him with the, you know, his fake voice and his fake name calling.
Unbelievable.
Just obsessed. Because I knew, you know, you mentioned Spy Magazine. I knew the story of Spy Magazine. They, back in the 1980s, called him a short-fingered vulgarian.
Right, right.
That was a phrase that they attached to him. He hated it. And he would circle pictures of his hands whenever he saw pictures of his hands, and he would mail it to Graydon Carter and Kurt Anderson, the two founders of Spy Magazine. For years he would do this. He was obsessed with proving to them that he did not have small hands. And so that's how he gets. Something gets under his skin and he just won't let go.
Yeah. Plus, if he had sued you, I guess he would have had to go in court and whip it out to prove that he didn't have a small member.
Yeah. And, you know, the real tragedy there is that now we know all about it from the Stormy Daniels book.
That's true. You predicted Donald Trump's victory in 2016. When you did that, did people take you seriously back then, or were you like the little boy who cried wolf and people were like, he's from The Onion, he's just screwing with us?
I don't know if it was that dismissive, but people really didn't believe it. I mean, they really were like, really? No. And yeah, there were a few other people, you know, prominent people who were doing that. Michael Moore was one of them. And yeah, I wrote this book called Trump's America. Buy this book and Mexico will pay for it. And it was all about how to behave in America after Trump is president. And it was written in 2015. And so we did a lot of research on Trump, and I really did believe that he would win because he's very competitive. And one of the things he's best at is winning. Like, that's just one of his skills, you know. He knows how to defeat people. So I believed in. I did a lot of interviews where I said as much. And it was pretty amazing when he was elected. We had self-published the book, but then Simon & Schuster came calling as soon as he was elected because they figured, okay, now this book is important. But so much of what's in that book has come true. It's really amazing.
Well, you've written another book now about another person who's pretty over the top and almost defies satirization, it seems, called Welcome to the Future, Which is Mine, by not Elon Musk and Scott Dickers. Just adding not in front of someone's names, did the lawyers tell you that covers you against defamation suits?
Yeah, I think that's why the publisher wanted to say not Elon Musk. They were worried about getting sued. And I was trying to explain to them, no, you don't understand. If he sues, that's great for us. Think of the publicity. But their lawyers aren't thinking that way.
Yeah, I'm sure. Now, what attracted you to Elon Musk?
I love the future, and I love sort of evil villain type characters who are trying to build the future, like the James Bond movie Moonraker and stuff like that. And so this is just a topic that I love. I made a movie called The Astounding World of the Future. This is just my thing. So when they came to me with the idea of, hey, we want to do some kind of Elon Musk book, I jumped all over it. And that's kind of how it came to me. It actually wasn't my idea to do this book.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So that'll happen sometimes. Usually I get the idea for a book and I write it and I try to publish it either by myself or with a publisher. But some on rare occasions, sometimes a publisher will come to me and say, you know, through my agent, we really think there should be a book about Elon Musk. And I normally don't do those books. But this time I was like, oh, yeah, totally. There should be an Elon Musk book. And there's more predicting of the future. And I just think a lot of these things are going to come true.
And much of this book does confirm what I've long suspected, which is that Elon Musk is or aspires to be a full-blown Bond villain.
Yes.
Do you think Elon's vision board includes world domination?
Yeah, well, I think he wants to dominate the world right before it's destroyed, and he's just going to go to Mars.
Yeah? Okay.
That's his plan. Yeah, and he, you know, he's going to help us out because he's going to burrow all these tunnels so we can all go underground and live like mole people after he and the elites escape to Mars.
I do figure that he could go either way, you know, because he could either turn out to be an accidental genius like Howard Hughes, who becomes the richest man in the world in spite of himself, or he ends up in the poorhouse or the nut house. What would you bet on?
I mean, anyone like that who's that rich and that eccentric but that capable is a lot closer to the nut house than the poorhouse.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we're all teetering on insanity, frankly. But yeah, somebody like that is really a fascinating character. He's like Trump. You know, you start investigating somebody and researching them to write a book about them, and you don't want to do too much, you know, because you don't want it to be in the weeds.
Yeah.
But people are fascinating, and some of these high achievers, people who are billionaires and want to be president or want to control the world or colonize Mars. I mean, these are fascinating people, and it's just really fun to knock them down a peg or two in my small way.
Yeah, and I joked about Howard Hughes, but, you know, it seems like he's not that far off now that he's living out of his office. You know, it's not hard to picture him shuffling around the factory with a long beard and Kleenex boxes on his feet.
Right, demanding that his assistant open the can of beans he's going to eat with rubber gloves
so she
doesn't get any germs on his food.
What do you think it's like working for a guy like that?
I can't imagine it's particularly pleasant.
Yeah.
There's an essay in the book about one of his employees, you know, fake, of course, where he gives advice to other employees on how to act around Elon Musk so that you're not jettisoned into outer space.
What would be one of the rules?
Oh, they're crazy. They're okay, if Mr. Musk is typing a Word document, you always have to do copy and paste for him. He doesn't know how to do copy and paste. Do not look directly into his eyes when copying and pasting. You know, and then he lists all these guidelines. He wishes everyone good luck. And at the end of the article, it says he was the chief space engineer. It says, update by new chief space engineer, RIP, original space engineer. The guy who wrote the article got jettisoned in outer space.
Yeah, and you talk about some of the new inventions that he's working on. We've already seen, you know, there's the Boring Company, the Hyperloop, SpaceX. What other things do you think he's working on?
Yeah, well, he's got the SpaceX bus, which is going to be a cheap ride to the moon or to Mars by bus. There will be no AC, and it will only have AM radio. But, you know, it's for the common people.
Yeah.
There's the Bluetooth-enabled death ray. There's the baby sleep cannon, shoots a laser at your baby and helps him sleep. A lot of fun stuff in here.
And I read in the book that Elon Musk wants to give driverless cars the right to vote. Do you think they'll be Republican or Democrat?
Well, he goes into that in great detail. It depends on whether they're a self-loathing car or a self-doubting car, because he's working on both. I think the self-doubting car would be the Democrat, and the self-loathing would be the Republican.
I have to say, the timing of this book couldn't possibly be better, with the SEC announcing that they're filing charges against Elon Musk as the result of his infamous funding secure tweet. You don't feel like you might be kicking poor Elon while he's down?
Yeah, I feel sorry for the poor billionaire.
Yeah.
No, it's great whenever this any kind of Elon Musk news happens. It only helps me.
Who do you think Elon Musk's nemesis is?
That's a good question. In the book, we theorize that it's Mark Zuckerberg, but it's not really a nemesis. It's more like Elon Musk and the other billionaires are always trying to avoid hanging out with Mark Zuckerberg. Like, he's the weirdo that they just don't want to be seen with.
Yes, and amazingly, you got Mark Zuckerberg to write the foreword to the book, didn't you?
Yep. I asked the publisher, like, okay, we have to say not Elon Musk on the cover. Why aren't you making us say not Mark Zuckerberg for this introduction? They didn't really have a good explanation for it.
Maybe Mark is less litigious.
I don't know. It doesn't seem like it.
Yeah. Now, do you worry that Elon's going to go on Twitter and accuse you of being a pedophile now?
Oh, no, I would hope that he would go on Twitter and say anything he wants about me and this book, you know.
When it comes to either Trump or Elon Musk, it just seems like reality is so absurd already these days. How do you satirize that? Do you feel like you have to ratchet up the satire even more?
Yeah, you mentioned that before, and it is an issue, like when you're dealing with somebody who is already kind of a hyperbolic person. Like, how do you exaggerate and hyperbolize that more? But, you know, I've been doing comedy a long time, and I know that there are other tools in the comedy writer's toolbox. Hyperbole is just one of them. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how in the weeds you want to get, but I wrote a whole book called How to Write Funny about how to write comedy and how to write humor. And there are 11 different kinds of jokes, and hyperbole is merely one of them. There's also irony you can do. And that usually highlights the hypocrisy of such people, which is always a fun place to knock them down a peg. There's character. There's shock, which we talked about, misplaced focus. So you just have to use some of the other tools and pile some of those things on. And there's no wanting for jokes. Like, even when somebody seems like they're just out of this world absurd, mm-hmm. you can always have fun with them and you can always make jokes about them that work.
For sure.
You know, sometimes you know, real life is always funnier than whatever you can come up with. That's just the reality of it. No matter how brilliant you are as a comedy writer, if you write a funny joke, it's never going to be as funny as seeing Aunt Myrtle slip and fall in the backyard pool and put that on Try Not to Laugh videos on YouTube. So whenever you can write something about one of these characters that are so hyperbolic like Trump or Elon Musk and it comes true, that's sort of the holy grail, because then you know that you actually hit on something that is funny in real life. There's no higher standard. And that's like when I'm at my most proud, is when something I write in either The Onion or one of my books that comes true, that like predicted the future. It's just a great feeling.
Well, what's the best advice that you give people who want to go into comedy writing?
The best advice I have is start where you're at. Like, people always want to get a job on a TV show or The Onion or something. And those are hard jobs to get. You got to start doing your own thing. You got to start a blog. You got to start going to open mic nights and doing stand-up. And you have to love it. You have to do it because you need and want to do it. And know that you're not going to be happy at some future point when you're successful. You need to be happy now doing it because you love doing it.
Good advice. Well, the book is called Welcome to the Future, Which is Mine, by Not Elon Musk and Scott Dickers. Scott, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Ben. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks again to Scott Dickers for coming on the podcast. One last time, Welcome to the Future, Which is Mine, by Not Elon Musk and Scott Dickers, is available on Amazon, Audible, and wherever books are sold. Read the latest side-splitting headlines on The Onion at theonion.com and keep up with Scott at scottdickers.com or on Twitter at @ScottDickers. You deserve a better email marketing platform, and unlike other email providers, Emma puts its customers first. It's powerful email marketing with a personal touch. Their award-winning team is always ready to support you on your email marketing strategy, design, list migration, and more, so you'll have everything you need to do your best email marketing yet. Request a customized demo of Emma's email marketing platform today at myemma.com. Again, that's myemma.com. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.